There are over 40,000 Chinese restaurants in the United States, making Chinese food one of the most popular ethnic cuisines in this country. Andrew Koh's new book, Chop Suey, looks into the history of Chinese food here and how it became such a staple of American dining despite a history of culinary and racial prejudice against the Chinese. The book is published by Oxford University Press, and I'm very pleased it has brought Andrew Koh to our show today. Hello.
Thank you.
Chop suey, the dish that gave your book its title, is rarely served in authentic Chinese restaurants. Is it at all authentic?
Yes, I think it is authentic. In my book, I trace the history of chop suey all the way back to 1880s New York. And at that time, from all the descriptions, it really sounds like a very sort of funky, earthy stew, a kind of specialty hash, which the residents of New York City's Chinatown like to eat. And the vast majority of those residents were from a particular town in South China called Toisan. And it sounds to me like the chop suey was a Toisanese local dish.
What about some of the other ones we associate with American Chinese cuisine, like chow mein, egg foo young, the poo-poo platters?
Well, the poo-poo platters are not part of that repertoire. But all the other classics of Chinese-American cuisine, the egg foo young, the egg rolls, the chow mein, are all South Chinese specialties from the Pearl River Delta area, which have been adapted to American tastes.
So what happened is they came here and they had to deal with the ingredients that were available and then with what non-Chinese liked. And we have this new cuisine. Because years ago I spoke to somebody who grew up in a Chinese restaurant in San Francisco, and he said, we had two refrigerators. We had the refrigerator for our Chinese customers and our family, and the one for all of the non-Chinese customers.
Well, what happened was is that the Chinese actually brought their cuisine almost intact to the New World. They built up trade routes. They started gardens all over the United States. And they really could get, like, authentic ingredients and make the food that they were used to back home. What happened was is that Chinese food became popular with Americans and with non-Chinese. And these non-Chinese had certain tastes. And gradually, the Chinese restaurant owners began to adapt Chinese food to American tastes. And bit by bit, it changed. And now, of course, you know, people would say that some of these dishes aren't Chinese at all, but they're all based on real Chinese food.
Well, in areas where there are a lot of Chinese people, the Chinese restaurateurs will make it a point to do things to appeal to Chinese clientele, whereas in other parts of the country, they serve white bread and do things that have nothing to do with any real Chinese cuisine.
Well, that's right. I mean, the quality of the food in the restaurant depends on who's eating there. And if you go into the restaurant and see that most of the people are Chinese and you look at the food on the plates and it looks like Chinese food, then that's, you know, Chinese food. But in other places where the most of the clientele is non-Chinese, then it's a different story.
Well, how much of it was also a matter of ingredients? Because until recently, a lot of the vegetables that go into authentic Chinese food were really not available here unless you brought them in from China in cans.
No, actually, that's not true. I mean, a lot of the there's a lot of ingredients which were imported from China, and that's things like soy sauce, dried fish, pickled vegetables, like these sort of specialty flavorings.
But snow peas, baby corn?
Well, the snow peas and the baby corn, well, the baby corn was, of course, canned mostly. But snow peas and dishes like that, the Chinese outside a lot of cities with large Chinatowns, particularly San Francisco and New York, had market gardens. And these were, you know, beginning back in the 19th century. And they began to grow the food that they were used to. I mean, they had seeds imported from China. But as Chinatowns began to dwindle in the 20th century, then those gardens also began to dwindle. So only, I think, around New York and San Francisco could you find them.
And that's because of our immigration laws?
Yes. Starting in the 1880s, immigration laws really restricted Chinese immigration until it was almost nothing. And that only began to open up after World War II. And the quality of the food was affected by immigration, as is always with ethnic foods.
Also, there was only a limited group of Chinese here. Most of them came from Canton, didn't they?
Right. Well, they came from Canton Province, which is known as Guangdong Province, and they came from a particular part of that, which was the Pearl River Delta, the area of Guangdong Province, which is south of the capital city of Guangdong, Guangzhou.
And why that area in particular? Just because when the Chinese were being brought into America to work on the railroads and such, that was the most accessible place?
To some extent. But what really drove them was these were the adventurers, the overseas adventurers of China. The people who lived along the southeast Chinese coast had a long history of going to foreign lands for wealth and as a way to escape poverty. And they came to the United States for exactly those same reasons. They went to Malaysia or you know, all over Southeast Asia.
How much did the fact that that we wound up with a very limited Cantonese population, mostly male, in fact, affect the kind of Chinese food we were getting?
Well, what happened was that, first of all, it affected the Chinese food in that we only had the Chinese food of a very certain small region of China. And the other problem was is that not very many of these people, the Chinese chefs, were actually, they were cooks. They were people who went into the restaurant business simply to support their family and make money. But they weren't people who was like their vocation was food. And that made a huge difference.
My guest is Andrew Koh, whose book, Chop Suey, A Cultural History of Chinese Food in the United States, is published by Oxford University Press. You trace Chinese food in America to one trip by the ship that the Empress of China had. What was that trip?
Well, in 1784, 1 year after the end of the American Revolution, the United States was poor and desperately in need of new trading partners. So a bunch of New York and Philadelphia merchants put together this ship because they'd heard that in China, people there was like a big market for ginseng, and there was a lot of ginseng in the United States. And so they sent this ship, the Empress of China, all the way around the world to China and actually to Guangzhou. And they sold the ginseng, and that's where the first Americans first ate Chinese food.
Who was Samuel Shaw?
Samuel Shaw was the supercargo. He was like the business agent in charge of the business side of the voyage. And he's the one who describes the eating the Chinese food.
And his journals really sold Americans on Chinese food, or at least introduced Chinese food to Americans?
Well, they were familiar. Some Americans were familiar with Chinese food from British and other travelers' accounts. But Samuel Shaw was the first American to give us a little bit of a more immediate experience of Chinese food. And what he found was that Chinese food was kind of the weirdest, most exotic food that in the face of the earth.
Because it is made differently than European food.
Yeah, it's very different. I mean, it has the basic ingredients, you know, like rice and the wheat noodles and the flavorings and the way the food is organized and the meal is organized. All that is very different.
And cooked in a wok, usually. Very small pieces, very quickly cooked. Chinese chefs have told me that they can always tell whether a chef just recently came over from China by the proportion of meat to vegetables in a dish, that the more Americanized the chef, the more meat there is in the dish.
Right. I mean, Chinese would never think, like traditional Chinese would never think of having a steak dinner. For them, a meal is a staple, usually, let's say, rice if you're from South China, with a bit of meat or vegetable as flavoring on top of it.
What was more important to the changes in Chinese food here, the Immigration Act of 1965 or President Nixon's trip to China in 1972?
Well, it was a combination of both events. The Immigration Act brought chefs – the change in the Immigration Act opened the door to chefs from the mainland who came from the mainland via Taiwan to get to the United States. And these were real serious trained Chinese chefs. But Nixon's trip to China made Chinese food cool. I mean, suddenly everybody wanted to eat real Chinese food.
People also wanted to get away from China at that time because it was the worst of Mao's Cultural Revolution. And we wound up getting all other kinds of Chinese cuisine we hadn't seen before, Sichuanese and Hunanese.
That's right. These were, after Nixon's trip to China, everybody wanted to eat authentic Chinese food. And in New York and San Francisco and Washington and a few other places, there were these Sichuan restaurants, these Hunan restaurants, serving weird new dishes. And some of them were the dishes what Nixon had eaten. And this was real Chinese food.
And even the Cantonese food, dim sum, suddenly became a big thing because that is a Cantonese cuisine. But we hadn't seen much dim sum until the 70s.
Right. Suddenly people started saying, dim sum was like everybody started going to HSF in Lower Manhattan and eating dim sum. That was the big thing. And that was another like authentic food.
Do you think that now with immigration policies being different, that there is much of a difference? We have bubble lounges. In fact, anything that is in Hong Kong, I assume, can be found in New York, perhaps San Francisco, and any number of other large Chinatowns.
Well, there's a lot of very interesting food in the many Chinatowns in the United States, but particularly in Los Angeles and New York. But the vast majority of those 40,000-plus Chinese restaurants serve food, which is kind of like a tired, very adapted to American tastes version of Hunan, Sichuan, and Cantonese food with a very limited menu.
And do Chinese people even bother going to those places?
Mostly not. But of course, Chinese people have been living here for a couple of generations. Their tastes are more American than Chinese, so they go.
And even in New York now, we have a debate over whether the old Chinatown in downtown Manhattan is the best Chinatown, because some people swear by Flushing and others are excited by the new Chinatown in Brooklyn.
Well, the old Chinatown in Lower Manhattan, I think is really good for Cantonese food. I live in Brooklyn, and I really enjoy Brooklyn's Chinatown. But for me, for new eating experience, Flushing is the place to go.
And why is that? Because the hot young chefs are more likely to go there?
Well, it's not the hot young chefs so much as chefs from parts of China that we haven't experienced before. I'm particularly fond of Dongbei cuisine, which is from the far northeastern corner of China. And there's a restaurant there called Golden Palace, which is just great.
Many people are confused about how to order in a Chinese restaurant because they go in and the three or four different things look really great on the menu and it all turns out to have the same brown sauce and there's no way for them to know. Are there ways to order so that you get a really interesting meal?
Well, if you've never been to a restaurant before and the dishes aren't familiar, what I simply like to do is I look what other people are eating, the Chinese people at the other tables are eating. And if it looks good, I just start asking the waiter or waitress, what are they eating? And then I begin to order that.
Well, Chinese people have suggested to me that the best way to eat is to go in with a group, maybe 8 or 10 people, tell the waiter how much money you want to spend and ask him to propose a meal because the chef knows what's really good and what's on the market and what he or she cooks the best. And then you could negotiate and wind up with a meal of a sort you never would have imagined otherwise.
Right. But that's best, of course, for more like a banquet. But for a spur-of-the-moment meal that, you're just going running out, then you have to take other things.
Uh-huh. And did this writing this book, did this involve your having to suffer going through a lot of restaurants all over the country?
Yes, it did. Weird suffering because, of course, I went to...
I was joking.
No, but I went to, Flushing and Brooklyn and ate the great Chinese food. But I also had to eat chop suey.
Mm-hmm. Can chop suey ever be really good?
It can be good. I wouldn't say great, but it can be good. Mm-hmm. Prepared in the hands of a chef... who respects the ingredients and can make a good version of it.
And I would assume the same is true for chow mein.
Yeah, well, chow mein is my problem with chow mein is of course the noodles. I don't like the noodles, but chow mein in most of these restaurants is simply chop suey poured over the crispy noodles rather than rice, as in chop suey.
Andrew Koh has written for Sever, Gastronomica, The New York Times. He's the co-author of Foie Gras Passion, and he's also contributed to the Oxford Companion to American Food and Drink. His book, Chop Suey, A Cultural History of Chinese Food in the United States, is published by Oxford University Press. Thank you so much for being with us.
You're welcome.